I'd like to go ahead and begin the introductions for our next panel.
Okay.
Everyone, we'd like to go ahead and begin with our next panel. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sean Ryan. I am a third-year law student at Vanderbilt University and an articles editor with LPAR. It is my pleasure today to introduce the panel that will be discussing Professors David Dana and Hannah Weissman's article, A Market Approach to Regulating the Energy Revolution, Assurance Bonds, Insurance, and the Certain and Uncertain Risks of Hydraulic Fracturing. Joining us today via phone is Professor David Dana, one of the co-authors of the article. Professor Dana is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at the Northwestern University School of Law. His scholarship focuses on the fields of environmental law, property, and land use. Prior to joining the Legal Academy, Professor Dana was a litigator with the Environmental and Natural Resources Division of the U.S. Department of Justice and a litigator in private practice as well. He began his career as a law clerk to the Honorable Betty Fletcher of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He has both a JD and BA from Harvard University. Next, it's my pleasure to introduce the commenters today. To my left is Ms. Leslie Carruthers. Ms. Carruthers is currently a visiting scholar at the Environmental Law Institute. Holding a BA from Smith College and an LLB from Harvard University, her career in environmental law has seen her serve in both the private and public sectors. Ms. Carruthers previously served as the president of the Environmental Law Institute. Before joining ELI, she served for 11 years as vice president, environment, health, and safety at United Technologies Corporation in Hartford. Her business sector experience also includes 4 years as senior environmental counsel for PPG Industries in Pittsburgh. She has also served with the US EPA, US Department of Justice, and as commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection. Next, it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Blaine Early. Mr. Early is a partner with the law firm of Stites & Harbison, and his practice involves a broad range of environmental issues with a focus on water and land issues, natural resources and energy, and the intersection of surety law and environmental regulatory matters. Prior to pursuing a career in law, Mr. Early served on the biology faculty of Cumberland College in Williamsburg, Kentucky. He holds a PhD in biology from the University of Louisville, a JD from the University of Kentucky, and a BA in zoology from DePaul University. And finally, it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Thomas Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald is the founder and director of the Kentucky Resources Council, a position he has held for over 30 years. Through his work at the KRC, he provides legal and strategic assistance without charge to individuals, community groups, and local governments throughout the state of Kentucky. In recognition for his environmental advocacy, he was awarded the Heinz Award in the Environment in 2008. Mr. Fitzgerald has a JD from the University of Kentucky. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Professor Dana and his PowerPoint.
This presentation is entitled Insurance and Bonding as a Regulatory Response to Risk from Fracking. And it is based on an article by Hannah Weissman and myself, published recently in the Iowa Law Review. The reason Hannah and I focus on insurance is based on our decision that the regulatory regime for fracking has limitations in terms of ex-ante regulation, and that one of the best ways to achieve a reasonable response to the risk posed by fracking is to focus on ex-post regulation through the liability system. In that sense, our argument is very similar to that of Tom Earls, who's already spoken at this conference. There are a number of reasons to focus on an ex post form of liability or imposition of cost in the context of fracking. One is that it's difficult to assess the risk ex ante for fracking. Fracking in some ways is an old technology, but it's also a new technology. And it's an evolving technology, so it's not straightforward for regulation to track those changes. In addition, one important issue regarding fracking is not simply the technology that's deployed, but also where the technology is deployed, and at least a good deal of the fracking activity recently is in areas of relatively heavy population, in contrast to a lot of oil and shale oil and gas development that happened previously. And finally, fracking is just happening in a tremendously intense way in certain regions, so the synergies, negative and positive, among the different wells and activities have to be considered. So partly, we're starting with the premise that some of the risks for fracking are uncertain and difficult to ascertain ex ante, and certainly difficult for government to ascertain, partly because government has less good information even than industry does. But even with better information, or ideally perfect information, we think regulatory agencies would have difficulties framing the best ex ante command and control regulation. Part of it has to do with the political economy of fracking regulation. State political dynamics and most regulation of fracking at this point is state level, has sometimes been associated with a close relationship between industry and industry such as the oil and gas industry and the regulators. So one doesn't have to go to the point of claiming capture to realize the regulation might be heavily influenced by industry's direct and immediate interests. In addition, most regulation in the United States, again, is at the state level, and that allows for a great deal of variability, and there are positive aspects to that. But it's also not as clear as some have suggested that regulatory insights from one jurisdiction to another will be shared. And because of all of this, and because of the heavy influence of industry and limited information on the part of regulators, we have a good deal of skepticism about the idea that best practices regulation will evolve as a matter of formal regulation in most states that can be relied on to adequately deal fully with the risk posed by fracking. And for that reason, we have a good deal of skepticism about the notion, moving forward to the idea of liability, that regulatory compliance should be a defense towards based on harms from fracking, even when there were regulations in place dealing with a particular risk issue. Liability regimes, of course, do a great number of things, but they don't work automatically, and there's some obstacles to having a liability regime work as a kind of way of dealing with the risk posed by fracking. One is the liability regimes require that ex ante, the participants believe that ex post there'll be some possibility of successful litigation. Otherwise, companies aren't going to be incentivized to try to avoid the cost of regulation. This requires also that landowners and localities and potential plaintiffs believe that there's a reasonable possibility of recovery. And we think to that end, the availability of broad pools of insurance are absolutely critical. If the participants in the legal system, plaintiffs, defendants, judges, others, believe that ultimately there won't be insurance proceeds to pay for liability if the requirements for liability even if they are established, that we don't really think litigation related to the harms of fracking will develop, and more importantly, will be anticipated to develop such that it will be a form of incentives ex ante. In the litigation that does actually occur or will ever occur with fracking, causation will be a major issue, but we think it's not always going to be an issue or significantly problematic issue in fracking litigation, and it's also not necessarily the case that we have to assume that any fracking regime for liability in the future will use common law tort causation rules. We could imagine also rules that relax the causation requirement and make fracking litigation look a little bit more or somewhat more like a CERCLA litigation. So our key point, our basic point, is that although thinking about liability as a regime is key, thinking in particular about bonding and insurance are an important part, a key part of that, to having an ex post regime that works. Why are insurance and bonding requirements so important? One reason is that these requirements address the problem of insolvency or judgment proofness. In the absence of mandatory insurance, in the absence of significant bonding requirements, it's not clear that there's going to be anyone to recover from once wells are depleted and once contamination becomes available. Therefore, litigation really won't serve either as a way to create a pool of money for remediation, which we think is an important thing to keep in mind. And it also really won't incentivize better behavior ex ante by industry actors, because if they understand that there's not going to be any viable litigation against them or an entity related to them, then there's not a strong reason for them to change their behavior, at least from a financial perspective. One of the instruments we therefore think should be focused upon is bonding. Bonds are, in theory, very useful. They've been used for a long time with respect to oil and gas and mines, essentially requiring bonds to be put up as a prerequisite for allowing a certain activity to be licensed or approved. But there are lots of problems with bonds, and bonding as it's currently done in the oil and gas and mining industry. Bond amounts are too low to cover even closure of most wells or mines. There's too little assessment of the amounts needed for different kinds of activities. For example, we think it would be important to have a regime where bonds are required not simply the plugging of a well or the closure of the well, but also decontamination of soils and waters nearby. In many states, it's too easy to get released from one's bond released, a company's bond's released. There's very little inspection or certification or self-certification. There are also lots of ways for companies to game the system of bonds by simply avoiding formal closure, which is often the trigger for having to pay the bond. And all of these bonding issues would have to be addressed if you're going to have an effective regime where bonding actually does do a lot of the work of incentivizing better behavior ex ante. And that, again, raises questions about if there's will for that. There are a couple of examples up in this slide from different states that do have bonding requirements for oil and gas wells. And they just point out, they just show that even jurisdictions that do have kind of requirements, the amounts really aren't sufficient either for actual closure, covering the cost of closure, or certainly for covering costs of decontamination or remediation on the well. Bonding has a number of advantages. Bonding can be set up essentially as a contractual relationship. Therefore, you avoid some of the causation issues implicit in tort. But really the question again is there a way to implement it well? In addition to bonds, we focus in the paper on insurance, really essentially mandatory insurance for fracking activity. Mandatory insurance doesn't exist in many jurisdictions. It is required under Maryland law, although Maryland really isn't a fracking state yet. It's required under Illinois law, although Illinois really hasn't really moved heavily into fracking either. And it's also required by some municipalities. We think there's a lot of value in an insurance, mandated insurance approach. Again, it's a way of assuring that there will be funds to pay for contamination, cleanup of contamination. And ex ante, insurers can perform a number of useful functions in a mandatory insurance regime. If there's mandatory insurance, insurers will require information disclosure as a prerequisite to insuring, as a prerequisite to setting premiums. They may well be much more effective in soliciting or eliciting effective information than mandatory disclosure regulations, which are maybe weakened as a result of political economy. Following up on that, insurers have an incentive to formulate and push for best practices or best procedures on a national basis, and we think they have a better incentive to do that in a way that's really, because they're trying to minimize liability, than does industry, which is also bound costs of complying with the regulations. And we think also that through setting premiums and also denying or allowing insurability, insurers can effectively gear fracking toward the places and ways that, in which it can be done that are the safest and that reduce risk while still allowing economic activity to go ahead. I have here a quote from a business insurance article talking about the current experience in fracking, which says that some insurers are covering fracking activities, but they're less likely to cover it or more expensive. The insurance is more expensive when you're in areas of a greater population density, such as the Marcellus Shale. We think that's actually a good thing, that if insurance actually channels fracking to the areas where the risks are lower, that would be a way in which mandatory insurance, in effect, could achieve a very positive or good regulatory effect. One of the big questions about insurance is whether it will be available. Insurance is less available even now in the market for long-tail contamination risks. Insurance companies are certainly leery about open-ended insurance. But there is now some fracking-related insurance being written in a range of products, and we think that there is a historical track record of insurance markets responding to demand, and that if there were mandated insurance requirements around the country in the major fracking states, there would be much more demand, and therefore a much wider range of products would be available. One of the things we hope to do in follow-up papers or follow-up work is talk more about how to operationalize in a particular way a regime with bonds and insurance. For bonds, I think we need, as compared to the current language in most states, statutory language that's specifically about wells where there's hydrofracturing, as opposed to just kind of talking about any kind of well or any kind of oil and gas well. We also need language that specifically requires the operator to do more than simply close or plug the well, but also deal with contamination, remediation, disclosure. We need a way to prevent companies to avoid formal closure by simply never reporting that the well is closed. It makes sense to have bond amounts not only higher than they probably are in general, but also higher for certain kinds of riskier activities and riskier locations. And one of the questions is whether that should be done through general rules, setting subcategories of fracking for different regions, different localities within a state, or whether there should be discretion given to the commissioners, to set bond levels. But the one-size-fits-all approach of bonds probably doesn't do as much work as something that's more tailored. And we also need better planning for insolvency. Although bonds, in theory, get around the insolvency problem, when companies, principals and sureties go into bankruptcy, you can still get issues. And some, one of the questions is how to try to pre-plan for those issues. Another important question is how to operationalize insurance requirements. Again, it probably makes sense as compared to the current statutory requirements, the few that exist, to have different amounts of insurance required for different settings where the fracking is more risky or less risky. Maybe dealing with where a particular company has a better risk profile or better risk management operations, you could require more or less insurance in terms of amounts. We also have to deal with the question of self-insurance. When does self-insurance meet statutory requirements? Does self-insurance do as good a job in terms of improving ex-ante incentives as third-party insurance? Our suspicion is no, and so one of the questions is to what extent should self-insurance be limited? And then the last question is, who gets to decide about mandatory insurance? We think it's important that localities be able to set mandatory insurance requirements. We think they have some of the strongest incentives since they bear the externalities of wells. But that raises difficult questions about preemption, which we, state law preemption of localities. One of the things that we think is an interesting thing to explore here is the development of a market for companies that will in fact do risk ratings, sort of like credit agency ratings, for different companies, different fracking activities, to meet this need on the part of insurers to know how much to charge and what to charge, and of states to know how much to require for insurance, and states to know how much, and localities to know how much to charge for bonds. And here we have a quote from Jory Calkins from a company called Independent Energy Standards, where he says that one of the areas we're working on is using our rating system to help insurance underwriters better assess and price risk of different oil and gas operations. We are in the early stages of working with a few different carriers right now with others in the queue. We are also having dialogues with regulators around bonding and insurance mechanisms and having a standing commitment from a major bonding underwriter for $100 million plus for some of these potential programs. So we think that a mandatory insurance requirement would also give rise to essentially entrepreneurs, business ventures that would focus on a risk rating, which would be in advance or would help the whole goal of risk mitigation or risk limitation via an insurance market. So that's essentially what our argument is, and we look forward to your comments, and thank you very, very much.
Do I have a choice? Advantages, I guess, are of being in the order in which I've appeared is so much has good stuff has been said. In addition to complimenting Professor Merrill, I thought the commenters on the first panel were just outstanding. So besides the fact that we need to make up a little time, I will go through this. Is that the clicker? Is that what I'm supposed to do with this? I knew I shouldn't have tried to do a PowerPoint.
Right.
Okay, where do I hit this the one on the left or the one on the right? Okay? All right, here we go. I do want to say, I don't have to say the thank yous this time because I'm no longer president as I was last time I was here. Scott did that. But I do want to tip my hat to the wonderful Vanderbilt students who were the heart of this program. One of the things that I enjoyed about being a visiting scholar at Pace and always enjoyed running ELI was getting to meet the fantastic young people who are entering the profession of environmental law and policy. It gives me great hope for our future, which sometimes I find waning a little bit as I look around, but there are so many terrific young students who are in this area that we can expect continued progress, I think, because of their energy and talent. I am supposed to comment on the Dana and Weissman article, although we were requested to read them all, and I did, and I learned a great deal. I will tell you my conclusion at the beginning and then dash through these slides to get to it, is that I think the more serious environmental impacts that I envision here are likely to result not from so much equipment failures and great big blowouts, but from a lot of on-site contamination by sloppy operations. And that most of this is a result of not having rules, but of people who don't follow them because the training and oversight by the companies is inadequate. I base that on my experience 15 years dealing with workforces in two companies. And so I think that company accountability is crucial. And I'm not satisfied that there's enough information in either article profiling this industry to make me confident that that the actors in this field can be counted on to be accountable. So I will explain my reasons for that as we go forward. We've talked about the new risks. When I was at ELI, I think maybe 2009, some of my lawyer friends wanted to talk to me about this new fracking stuff and wanted ELI to have a program on it, and their position was natural gas is good. I agree with that. Their position also was that the risks were pretty well understood because of years of oil drilling in the West. Well, not quite so clear. We've talked about some of the differences in the when you combine horizontal drilling and fracking and horizontal drilling, the technology, the scale of the area affected, and of course the greater site sensitivity in that this is now being done more not, and this is a little bit of a stereotype, but in the wide open spaces of the West, but in the much more congested and forested areas of the East. And so this is bound to present additional issues. I agree entirely with Professor Merrill that the main issue is water, the quantity. I think the estimate he gives is 2 to 4 million gallons of water per well. The quality issues, both the chemicals used in the process, and as Brad pointed out, the fact that the process itself pulls out materials, some of which are not so great, from the underground. And then, of course, the disposal issue, the fact that this material is not treatable by most POTWs, or that's what I'm told, and then, of course, the risks associated with underground injection and depending on the amounts, earthquake risks, as well as simply difficulties in managing the transport and execution of the disposal. The key issues are, and I'm not going to elaborate on these on this slide, are what are the processes that need management and control, and who are the industry players who are responsible for the processes? I think we know and have learned both from the articles that we read and from the presenters and some of the commenters that there are lots of technical resources and ideas out there for how to handle this problem. The question is figuring out how to get them, how to apply them. I was glad to hear from the Sustainable Shale Group about what they're doing. I do think that unlike the old days, we're a little more attuned to the virtues of pollution prevention strategies. What can we take out of this water in advance that reduces its potential hazards, and how can we set the stage for being able to recycle more of it? Those seem to me the key points, and I hope a lot of work is being going on this. The next issue, though, is, for me, the one I'm going to focus on a bit more, is making the standards stick. We have, of course, traditional enforcement, inspection, citations, and fines. That's a little tough, especially since, according to EPA's estimate in one of the articles, I forget which one, 11,000 wells are being drilled every year. The state resources are already stretched. How do you manage that? That level of permitting and oversight, it's a very big challenge for the states. In addition, there are a great many different players at different stages of production. That we do know. This complicates the enforcement task as well, and there is bound to be variability in their technical and managerial and financial capabilities. I think that even reading the two articles, I think that the only substantive, really, criticism I have is that I would have liked more about the actual makeup of the fracking industry. There's a New York Times article cited that says big oil company drillers are acquiring some of the little guys. Great, they have better performance. But their same Wall Street Journal has an article saying smaller companies are entering the pressure drilling fracking phase compared to larger companies. I did not attempt to answer this question myself, but I did read a few articles, one by the Manhattan Institute, stating that as of that there are 20,000 small companies in the industry with a median employment of 15. That doesn't say how many are involved in fracking, but gives you an idea of the scale of companies. And the Independent Petroleum Refiners Association reported in an article attached to the Manhattan Institute report that non-major oil companies drilled 94% of our natural gas wells. This is as of 2011. And employed about 400,000 people in extraction and drilling jobs. Well, who are these guys? That's the question that I have, and I am in no way taking the position that a small company cannot competently manage a well site and the operations that go with it. I mean, there are millions of wonderful construction companies, and they can be well managed and effective. But I do know from my own experience that the challenge is getting people, especially at remote locations, to follow the rules, to do what they're supposed to, not to take shortcuts, and that the character of the management of the company is extremely important in whether that happens. One of the things that was listed in the Independent Refiners report was that much of the activity that these companies engage in is drilling for others or providing support activities on a contract or fee basis. Well, what do those contracts say? You know, I have to say that occasionally large companies attempt to defer liability for certain offenses by their contractors to the contractors and try to create barriers to having any liability from the larger entities who may be the permit holders. So I simply find that whole area I have questions in that area that aren't answered by either of the articles. I think they could be by some kind of study, and it might satisfy my concerns. But I think that uncertainty in itself strengthens Professor Dana and Weissman's argument for insurance requirements. I'm not going to recapitulate the arguments that he made much better than I could, but it does seem to me that insurance requirements are a good match if you're dealing with multiple and diverse capabilities on the part of the industry players here, and I think quite possibly we are. Of course, it can reduce the burden on the government staff. It does allow adjusting rates to the sensitivity of sites, and it can contribute, as he points out, the insurance industry has been aggressive in some industries in helping to foster and push the development and implementation of best practices. And at the end of the day, you know, I happen to agree with Professor Dana and Weissman that we can have the best and well thought out liability scheme in the world, but if there isn't any pocket with money in it that you can get at, you know, it's not going to be effective. And I think that insurance could possibly provide the resources for cleanup, for closure, compensation for tort claims. And that, frankly, we cannot assume that these folks are going to be solvent, who are the actual players in this industry. And maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But insurance does give us more of a guarantee that there will be resources. In the past, frankly, the states, I think, have been suckers, although willingly. I mean, they basically have a huge inventory of oil drilling and mining sites that were never cleaned up, even though they were supposed to be. And this has become a public sector headache, and there certainly aren't resources for it now. I hope we'll be a little smarter in the future, and I think they will. I can't assess whether the insurance industry is going to run into this with the embrace insuring this industry eagerly, but I can certainly say that if there's a mandate, there will be a market. And that's generally the way things work. And I have confidence that they may want to do this. The last slide I want to show is not a critical comment relative to the articles, but it's a question that I think it's addressed, for one thing, in ELI's report, Getting the Boom Without the Bust, Guiding Southwestern Pennsylvania Through Shale Gas Development. It's a very interesting report on ELI's website. And this picture, by the way, is not from that. It's from the Energy Information Administration. It's 2005 to 2012 data. The red dots are horizontal drilling. The black ones are vertical. But the point I want to make here is that neither article really attempts to deal with this. It's very hard to figure out how to deal with this. Pennsylvania uses impact fees and may, now that the Supreme Court has reversed its overly permissive rules on fracking and restored some local authority, perhaps some local land use controls. But when you look at this, I think about the actions of New York and Maryland, for instance, in not being willing to venture at this point into approving this. I'm not saying that I support that or necessarily agree with it, but if I were a state commissioner looking at this map for Pennsylvania, I would say to myself, if I were sitting in New York or Maryland, geez, are we ready to handle this? So I think that there is a question of the simple landscape disturbance and impacts of whether it's roads or pipelines or well sites or spills or contamination. There's a lot going on here, and when you multiply it by the numbers that you see on a map like this, it is a cause for concern. So there's plenty of room for further thought about how these kinds of impacts can be fashioned. But I just want to conclude by saying that I think both of these articles were really an outstanding contribution to understanding the challenges that we face and coming up with lots of creative and interesting ideas for how we meet them. And I thank the authors for their work. Having written my first and last, I believe, law review article, which was published by Berkeley on New Year's Eve, so I don't think it made your cut. I have enormous respect for the academic community and for the amount of work it takes to put together something and articles of this particular quality. So my hats are off to the four authors, and I thank ELI for including me in this terrific program.
People up in my face. Thank you. I will begin by echoing Leslie's comments and compliments to the authors and our thank yous to Vanderbilt and to ELI for the opportunity. Again, this is a tremendous compilation of information, and it's a pleasure to be here and a privilege to comment on these. I want to tell you, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a practitioner. I live in Kentucky, one of the flyover states. And I represent a variety of interests, sureties among them, as well as producers in the oil and gas fields of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, coal interests in Kentucky, the Illinois Basin, out to the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana, and gold mining interests in Nevada. So I've got a kind of an on-the-ground perspective here. I do have to give you the disclaimer that these comments are not comments on behalf of any of my clients, current or former. They don't represent the viewpoints of my firm. They're mine alone, so I'm guilty if there's any problem. I want to focus on differentiating surety and insurance, because I think that the first point raised in Professor Dana's article about command and control versus the market-based, and the author's comments about bonds and their applicability and insurance bear some kind of fine-tuning as we look at these mechanisms to provide the kind of protection going forward. I do concur with their conclusion that insurance is going to be a key, but there is a role for surety to play. And I won't elaborate, but the same objections and the response to those objections that the authors gave about why insurance may be a problem apply equally to surety bonds. I want you to remember a phrase as we go through this. That is, bond the things you know, insure the things you don't. So with that, we're going to look at some lessons we have from some of the natural resources programs. Looking first at the Surface Mining Act, I've outlined here some of the obligations that a coal mining entity, a permittee engaged in surface coal mining operations, has to perform. In order to get that permit, in order to get that governmental authorization, one of the requirements is that the permittee has to furnish a reclamation surety bond, or some other kind of financial assurance. It can be a letter of credit, it can be securities, they can even put cash up with the regulatory agency. Most of these you see are related to land reclamation, restoring original contour, establishing vegetation, and so forth. There is a provision for what's called restoring the hydrologic regime, which is often looked at as groundwater pollution or sometimes long-term acid mine drainage. the bond amounts are usually calculated based on what it should be determined that the agency would have to spend if the mining permittee went away and the agency had to take over the reclamation obligations. For bonding the water pollution, and in some cases if it's long-term water treatment, the bond amounts are often typically calculated on the basis of 20 to 30 times the annual treatment costs. Now, one aspect about this bonding for coal mining is that there is a statutory and a regulatory phased sequence of bond releases. So you may put up $1 million to begin with, complete the land reclamation and establishing approximate original contour, get 60% of that bond release, establish vegetation for a couple of years, get another 15, and so on. So there is a provision, high cost up front, but then as some of the risk is addressed, the bond amounts go down, making them more affordable. There is a similar regime in FLIPMA, although there really isn't a phased bond release, but again, in these kinds of regulations, the Federal Policy Mining Act that govern hard rock mining, focus again on land reclamation a little bit to deal with water. Now turning to oil and gas, Professor Merrill talked about the recent rulemaking from BLM. This is from the BLM regs dealing with oil and gas leases on federal lands. I've drawn these points from the regulation that deals specifically with bonding. And so the new aspects in the new rule that come under some of the operational requirements, such as documenting the casing and the cementing done at the well, requiring the produced water and the returned fracking fluids to be stored in actual containers, not ponds, lined or unlined. Those things aren't really part of the named bonding requirements, but arguably, as we'll talk about, they would be part of the bonded obligations. What's not in there, though, are the aspects of what happens, you know, what if there is migration of methane into the drinking water? What if some of these fracking fluids migrate to aquifers? What if somebody, either by mistake or on purpose, releases the fracking fluids, the waste fluids, into surface waters? Now, one thing that BLM didn't do in this new rulemaking is to adjust the bond amount. Not only did they not require disclosure of the fracking chemicals, but they specifically addressed comments and said, we're not going to raise bond amounts. And they said that BLM believes that it has authority under existing regulations to adjust bond amounts to address any increased liability that may result from hydraulic fracturing. So they think they have the authority. The question is, do they have the will to do it? Do they have the will to actually increase those bond amounts? And then look at that last phrase, and I'm going to highlight it on the next page. The great unknown in all this, and we've talked about this and very, very capably pointed out by the authors and the commenters, is what about liabilities to third parties? Well, in the regs, in the bonding regs from BLM for oil and gas on federal lands, it's very clear. The agencies don't treat that. That's completely a separate consideration. Third parties, landowners, municipalities, whatever, who's being affected, those are going to be handled under other forms of law, but not those oil and gas regulations. So how does this all fit together? I want to use two illustrations here to highlight some of the differences between the surety bonds and insurance policies. This is a triangle diagram showing the traditional three-party relationship in a surety relationship. Those of you who are lawyers may remember first semester contracts. Excuse me. You learned under the statute of frauds that contracts of surety have to be in writing, and then we all forget about it. Well, surety is a big business. There's a tremendous commitment, but it's very, very precise and very ancient. There are many surety rights involved here, but the surety bonds a contract. In this case, if you look at the lower two entities, the agency on the left and the permittee on the right, the agency has specific and imposes specific command and control obligations. You have to do this. You have to drill the well at a certain location. You have to put in a certain kind of casing. You have to do this. You have to do that. Those are specified in the regulations and or the permit. The permittee applies for that permit, gets the permit. Often one of the requirements is they have to provide financial assurance, and that's where the surety comes in. The surety issues a surety bond. That in these kinds of bonds that are issued with regard to statutory programs, there's abundant case law that says that the bond itself incorporates the language of the statutes and regulations that it is required by. So the surety takes on, again, the specified bonding regulations set out by, the bonded obligations set out by regulation. In return, in order to issue that bond, the surety and the permittee will separately contract. There's often an elaborate screening process, an underwriting process. Talk more about that in a minute. But one of the things that they'll do, in addition to requiring the payment of premiums, is requiring a posting of collateral. Now, again, if you're a permittee, and just using round numbers, the bond amount may be $1 million. Maybe you don't have $1 million in your bank account to put up for the government to hold for 2 decades. So you'll go to the surety, who will put their financial wherewithal, issue a $1 million bond, but they'll want some collateral. They don't want to be left out if the organization goes bankrupt. And then they will often require a written indemnity agreement. And in that indemnity agreement, the principal, the permittee, will agree to indemnify and hold harmless the surety. In some cases, the sureties and the principals will negotiate and get not just the permittee, but also associated companies. So you get the parent company, all the subsidiaries, sometimes you get sister companies, and sometimes they go as far as requiring the individual personal guarantee of company officers, directors, and sometimes even their spouses. So in this case, to encourage doing the right thing, the surety has a tremendous club. You know, permittee, if you don't do this, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, and they call my bond, they forfeit my bond, I pay that $1 million, well, I'm going to go after your house. And that's a tremendous incentive for compliance. An insurance policy, on the other hand, is really a two-party contract between the insurer and the insured. And what the insurance company is saying is, insured, in this case the permittee, if you cause trouble and if a third party sues you, then I will indemnify you. I'll defend you, I'll go into the court, I'll defend you, and if there's a judgment, I'll pay that. Or if you have equipment that's damaged, then I'll pay for that equipment. But the relationship there is between the insurer and the insured, not the third parties. The third parties go ahead and, as we've talked about this morning, they sue according to common law, they sue according to statutory rights, but it's the insurance company that steps in and defends. So then, summarizing these two sets of obligations, surety and insurance. Surety is a three-party relationship. Insurance is a two-party relationship. Surety is really a financial accommodation. The surety is putting its financial backing behind the permittee. What the insurance company is doing is saying, if something happens, I'll step in and defend and indemnify. The surety expects no loss. It's just like the bank that loans money to buy your house. They don't expect to chase you into foreclosure. They give that loan and they take collateral. They have people to co-sign for the loan. The surety expects no loss. They're going to do that by taking collateral and by taking indemnity. On the other hand, insurance is a gamble. It's Monte Carlo to the nth degree. So they're saying, okay, there's this broad-based risk in the market, and we're going to charge this premium. As the authors have pointed out, maybe there's a benefit to premium if you adopt certain kinds of safeguards. But in the bottom line, they're betting that they won't have to pay off more than they take in premiums. And then again, as we mentioned already, there's the hammer of the collateral and such that can be used by the surety to help encourage performance. So again, the surety bonds those specific known types of risks. The insurers take a broader gamble. Now, some of the ways, I'll just close here very quickly. We've talked about some of the mechanisms, and I do want to highlight this new rule from BLM with increased requirements for the cementing and casing testing and assuring the structural integrity of the well. Perhaps we could set up some kind of surety phased release. Perhaps the regulatory authorities, the issuing authorities, could have a higher bond amount, but it would be you'd know exactly what was required. Then once the well bore was placed, once the casing was in place, once the structural integrity was assured, then you go away. But I'll tell you that there isn't a surety. Well, yeah, I'll make that prediction. There's not a surety around that's going to issue a full cost bond that is open-ended that says, well, if there is ever any water contamination, come see us. They won't do that. That's not the surety business. That's the role of insurance. Thank you.
get the unenviable job of standing between you and lunch.
Well, no, actually, we're going to have a little bit of a discussion, so.
All right. I appreciate this opportunity. I am thrilled to see this sort of participation by students and by younger folks in these conversations, particularly as I age. I'm now, somebody said, congratulations, you've started your seventh decade. I said, could you really have phrased that a different way? When I was introduced, they talked a little bit about the Resources Council, but let me just talk a little bit more so you can understand my viewpoint and completely discount everything I have to say from here forward. The Resources Council operates on a legal aid model. I used to be with legal aid in Eastern Kentucky, the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund, until the Reagan administration got in and began to zero budget legal services and started to substantively restrict what we could do in terms of representation. So I came to the Resources Council. It used to be the Kentucky Rivers Coalition. They fought the Corps of Engineers big dam projects, or dam big projects, depending on whether you were one of the farmers in their path during the 1970s and 80s. And we don't tend to see people when they're at their best. Nobody calls and tells us that the air is pure, the brook is babbling, and the land is verdant. We get the call from the woman in Harlan County up in the mountains who says, Mr. Fitzgerald, there is a man in a moon suit next door, and he's digging dirt and putting it in a baggie. And I went to ask him what he was doing, and he said, ma'am, there's nothing to worry about. She said, and I don't know whether to believe him or not. And so turns out it was a Superfund site in the making where someone had indiscriminately dumped industrial waste as part of a solvent cleaning process for 30 years. It cross-contaminated three separate drinking water aquifers, including the one that the trailer park had been getting her semi-public water supply from. So with that understanding that I don't tend to see people at their best, let me react to both sets of articles. I was very impressed with both articles, and I view them not as being in opposition, but being complementary to each other and looking at how to address what Blaine, my colleague, who I'm very proud to be able to hang out with him. We had to come to D.C. to do this. We're only 90 minutes away otherwise, but we have to come to D.C. to be able to hang out. I wanted to just underscore kind of the perspective of somebody who has worked with the state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, since 1972 on environmental issues. I cut my teeth on the Surface Mining Act. Actually, was walking these halls in 1972 and 73 trying to ban steep slope strip mining. Of course, those of you who remember the oil embargo, it was right around that time. It was a little bit of a hard sell to try to convince Congress to regulate the coal industry more rigorously. But the regulation in Kentucky is not all that unique. We are the fourth poorest state in the United States. We are one of 23 states that have what are called no more stringent than clauses in our state environmental statutes. Those are clauses that are intended to make the federal floor of regulation under the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Surface Mining Act, that floor preemption that Congress did, this turns that into the ceiling. So it basically says we will be no more stringent than we are obligated to be under this law, because the legislators largely see a benefit to locally permitting as opposed to having Atlanta or Washington do it. But there's a misguided and very powerful myth that undergirds, particularly states where there's a lot of extractive industry like Kentucky, and that is that environmental protection is bad for business. So we want these programs, we will do the minimum required of us and no more. So that, it tends to be very reactive. A lot of the states you're dealing with, particularly in the Appalachian Basin, there has been historically a lot of capture of the regulatory mechanisms and of the legislatures because of the dominance of the industry in terms of being an engine of the economy. The shale revolution has been remarkable in many respects, both positively and negatively, and the benefits and the burdens are not equally distributed. The concerns that I tend to see are not just concerns from the environmental community that we're going to slow the rate of renewable deployment, but is looking at communities that are not used to being treated like the national sacrifice area. Okay? The Appalachian region has been abused long enough that there is a fatalism regarding the ability to extract coal or extract natural gas or extract any other resources, timber resources, without abusing the land and the people and the public infrastructure. Now you're seeing shale gas development in areas that are not used to being treated in that way. And there is a lot of pushback. There's a lot of the socioeconomic issues associated with boom towns in the West and the East that are really not effectively grappled with. And so a lot of those impacts, you know, we're talking about a small slice of the impacts of shale gas exploitation or exploration development. Kentucky is also not unique in that our regulatory framework for oil and gas is based on the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission recommendations. They were adopted in 1960 in Kentucky. The IOGCC was created by the states as a mechanism for developing standards for conservation of the resource. After a ruinous era where people were depleting resources and freezing resources in place by drilling too closely, by wildcatting and not properly closing the wells, not properly managing the environmental impacts. So the IOGCC developed this model legislation and model regulations. It seems Orwellian to people when I mention it, but water is considered a contaminant under most of these regulatory programs. Okay? Now, at the end of the day, you get to the same goal, which is to keep the product in the well and keep the groundwater away from the product, okay, and away from anything you're injecting or withdrawing. But water is considered a contaminant because the resource, the natural resource being conserved is the oil and gas under this regulatory model. It's a little bit of a shift to now say, hey, we're protecting the water because this stuff's the pollutant. But, and when I tell people that, they're like, professor, what? Because I moonlight as a professor over at the Brandeis School of Law. I'm the longest standing lowly adjunct at the, since 1986, and I'm certainly not here representing them. They just like to say we truly are equal opportunity. Look, we let this guy teach. So, I guess the points I wanted to leave you with on regarding the role of regulation as opposed to how much reliance we place on bonding and insurance is there are some real benefits from engaging the risk-based sectors, whether it be the sureties or the insurers. And there's one example that we had. Blaine talked about the fact that under the Surface Mining Act, there is an obligation to post a reclamation bond. And that bond, which can either be self-bonded, which I have some real problems with, we don't allow that in Kentucky, some states do, but it can be a surety bond, it can be a collateral bond, it can be a cash bond, or a combination of those. And it can be a bond that applies to an area and then is phased, so as you move to the next area, you can reapply the bond. Even with a federal mandate that you have a bond that is sufficient to allow a third party to come in and complete the reclamation plan, it doesn't happen in most states. The bonding levels are grossly inadequate. And even with that federal mandate, it has taken us 20 years in Kentucky to get to the point where there was enough of a crisis that the federal agency threatened to withdraw that portion of the program if Kentucky didn't get its act in gear. And in response to that, they upped the bonds individually significantly and then created a bond pool. And I'll come back to that because I think there's a wrinkle on Professor Daner's proposal that could be very helpful, and we have a model of how it's already worked. There is no perfect answer for it, but Blaine is right. What I think that, and the speakers earlier, what you try to do is you try to identify those standards that are sufficient to assure the integrity of your well, the integrity of the formation into which you are drilling to produce, proper management of your waste and your wastewaters, and then you backstop the unknown risks with some sort of a mechanism that will assure that third parties and the environment do not suffer externalized harms associated with the production of this of natural gas or natural gas liquids. We had an example in Kentucky. There's a company called Reclamation Surety. I'm not sure if they're still doing business anymore, but some years ago, one of the guy who was the head of the inspection force left the state and went to this company, and what they would do is they would write surety bonds, but they had their own inspections, and they had higher standards because they knew all the games that people could play, okay, in terms of not getting reclamation done contemporaneously. Because like the closure of the well here, reclaiming a mine site is a non-productive activity. That's money out of pocket. And so the same way that people don't want to close a well in a timely manner, they will overlap high walls, which are the vertical areas left when you're strip mining, in order to pass those on to the next generation because they don't want to pay the money to move the dirt to reclaim them. So there are opportunities there if you can engage the insurance industry, and that I see is one of the big problems. Because, as somebody mentioned with the interim idea, there is no credible threat right now of federal regulation of oil and gas on private lands. And when there was, some years ago, you saw the IOGCC move into action to try to help improve the state regulatory programs in order to avoid federalization of the regulation as it had occurred in the coal industry. There was a group called Stronger, which was a collaborative group that worked on identifying weaknesses in the state programs for waste management and regulation and improving those. And I'm not sure if Stronger is even still going. It produced two reports in Kentucky, but there was very little done in terms of momentum to adopt because there is a lot of capture from the extractive industries in the legislative process. It is very difficult to look to the states because states, as many of you can intuitively assume, the reason we had federal regulation of mining, for example, is because the states tend to be fairly parochial when it comes to protecting their own industries. And when you have industries that are fairly mobile, okay, somebody who's doing deep well hydrofracking can do that in Ohio. They can say, well, if you want to raise the limits, we'll go down to West Virginia or we'll go to Kentucky, because you have shale resources that expand, that stretch through five or six states. So you're looking at that potential for one downsmanship that was so endemic in the mid-70s and early 70s in the coal industry. And so absent a federal interim fear that this is the devil we know as opposed to taking a federalizing this issue, I don't know how you convince state legislatures to impose a meaningful insurance requirement on the industry. Dealing with the oil and gas industry in the Commonwealth has been a fascinating process for the past, it started out many years ago dealing with produced water issues, because even in traditional oil and gas development, you have, for every barrel of oil that comes out, you have 10 to 20 barrels of carbonate water that's been in the formation since dinosaur days, which has to be managed and disposed of. And so we went through that fight many, many years ago. I don't want to understate how difficult it is to create a public environment in which the industry believes that it is in their best interest to accept a reasonable level of regulation. How to deal with and mitigate the risks of the long tail, which is with both Professor Merrill and Dana identified, is fairly daunting. We're talking about, the immediate impacts of well completion, right, and the reclamation of the areas that are associated with it. And then we're talking about a tail 30 to 40 to 50 years later in a producing well where the closure is going to be required. If we require a bond, will that surety still be in existence? If we require an insurance policy, will that company still be there to underwrite 30, 40 to 50 years? Look at the upheaval that has occurred just in the last 10 years and tell me that there's any way that we can rest assured that a private insurer will be there to stand, to backstop those issues. Will they write the policies is the other question. You look at the underground storage tank program, which was under the 1984 amendments to the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Originally, the idea had been to put those abandoned sites under CERCLA, under Superfund, which would have made the folks who installed them, mostly under franchise systems, jointly and severally liable. But just as those companies were divesting themselves of those underground tanks and selling them to the folks who used to run the franchises for a dollar, they were up here on the hill saying it ought to be handled under RCRA and the current owner should be responsible. So what happened? So the moms and pops got screwed, and they couldn't find somebody to write an insurance policy. That's why the states created bond, created the funded mechanisms like the underground storage tank fund we have in Kentucky, where the public pays into a fund to clean up these old sites, because the insurance mechanisms simply weren't there to pay for the remediation of these contaminated sites. The issue regarding, and I'm almost done, the issue regarding liability is an important one, but please do not leave here thinking that access to courts is a meaningful concept for most of the low and fixed income people who live in these producing areas. It is not. Okay? We have, in Kentucky, the Resources Council has a staff of 1.5, and we cover the entire Commonwealth. There is an Appalachian Citizens Law Center, which does excellent work over in Eastern Kentucky, and they like our work. They are free, of course. You get the quality of what you pay for, though. So, the resources are simply not there. Under the American rule, the individual, even if they win a case, they eat their own attorney's fees. Most of these properties are not significant in terms of the before and after value differential, certainly not enough to support litigation. The compensation for the loss of a water supply is really a very difficult issue, because many cases what you're dealing with is shallow wells in a fracture flow regime that is easily contaminated and very difficult and costly to replace. So, all that having been said, Kentucky, I think there is a good model here, and this goes back to some of the work that is being done at the Center for Sustainable Shale Development, which I was very pleased to be able to listen to that presentation. 1960s, when we became part of the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. It was 1974 before anything was done to reform our statutes regarding oil and gas development. 1974, we imposed an obligation that if you damage a water supply, you replace it. Okay? Diminished, contaminated, interrupted, if it's being used for any beneficial purpose, you replace it. All you prove is causation, and I don't say all, that's not a minimal issue, but you don't have to prove that they violated a standard. It doesn't matter. As between you and the person who supply you damage, you bear the risk, and not that person. We had a reclamation plan obligation, but it only applied where there were severed surface and minerals. So if you were a lessor who wasn't savvy enough to write into your lease what should be done in terms of reclamation, you were screwed. 2003, in response to a local government trying to regulate gathering lines, which are the lines that go from wellhead to the compressor stations, the legislature and the Commonwealth preempted local governments, except for zoning and planning. Very few communities in oil and gas producing areas have zoning and planning in Kentucky. It's not a popular concept until the junkyard moves in next door. And then it's a little bit late. In this past year, in May of 2004, the Energy and Environment Cabinet convened a work group. And understand, fracking has been going on in Kentucky for decades, but it is nitrogen foam fracking using a fraction of the water that's being used under much lower pressures in much more shallow shale formations, because we have enough clay in our formations. If you used high volume water, you're going to seal up the very formation you're trying to fracture. So we've got experience with horizontal drilling and small-scale fracking. But there was a concern that there is starting to be development in Kentucky, and interest in the Rogersville Shale, which is part of the Marcellus formation. So we sat down as part of a work group over an eight-month period with the industry. And I've got to tell you, the industry ranges from some very progressive folks to folks who make the coal industry look like they embrace regulation. It's a little Wild West still out in some of the areas. But we managed to come up with a consensus bill, which was adopted without a dissenting vote by the House and Senate during the last legislative session, which ended last month. And what it does is it anticipates some of the issues of both of these, I'm sorry, it provides for water testing, pre and post drilling. It provides for caps any blanket bonds and requires increased performance bonds. It requires disclosure of all fluids. We do not allow trade secrets for chemical identity in Kentucky any longer. And it provides a mechanism for reclaiming abandoned sites. And that's where I want to end, is to talk about the alternative when you're looking at the long-term risk of having an actuarial-based pool where you pay as you go during the production phase, and that pool of money is available to reclaim sites if, in fact, the private insurer defaults or the surety bond is no longer in effect. So you don't socialize those costs, but you allow an incremental way of funding liabilities that are 30 or 40 or 50 years down the road. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we are obviously running way behind schedule, but I have to say I think the comments have really been excellent. I mean, just very, very thoughtful. What I'd like to do is call back up the first panel, and we're going to have a bit of an abbreviated discussion given the schedule. And in fact, what I'd like to do, I might just stand right up here at the microphone and ask people to sort of treat this as if you're on a Sunday morning talk show, and you get 30 seconds, 1 minute to make your point. And try to just move it faster, because I think everyone has responses. I mean, again, the comments were just, I thought, you know, very thought-provoking. So what I'd like to do, actually, is start with Professor Dana, since he is remote. And David, would you like to take 30 seconds or so? And just please all forgive me if I'm rude in interrupting you and encouraging you to move on. But I do really want to have the opportunity for the discussion. We just have an incredible panel here. David, can you go ahead and respond to what you've heard?
I'm sorry I couldn't be there. I thought everything I heard was really interesting. Some of it I couldn't hear, to be honest, because of the remote connection. One of the things I just wanted to emphasize on David Sizer's paper is I agree with a lot of their suggestions, the two papers, as kind of suggesting digital reforms that can work together. It was really all the I could hear.
David?
Yes.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. I don't know if I hope you're not on a speakerphone, but it's breaking up a bit, so I really apologize, but we're going to move on because it's just a little too hard to hear.
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay, I understand.
Thank you for joining us. Tom, do you want to? Oh, no. Okay, can you thank you for bearing with us on these logistics.
I think what David was saying in part was that there's a lot of synergy between the papers, which I fully agree with. And I completely agree with the analysis of the importance of having either adequate surety bonding or adequate insurance to handle the insolvency risk and the post-closure problems and so forth. I sort of want to raise some questions about insurance and then kind of weave some other thoughts in doing that. 30 seconds. First of all, I think it's important to remember that landowners and other people that are concerned about fracking are not going to be satisfied when you tell them that, well, you can sue the energy company, or the energy company's got this insurance policy, so in case, you know, they're held liable for destroying your water supply, you can be assured that you're going to get compensated for that. The people that are upset by fracking and are apprehensive about it want to be told that their water supply is not going to be destroyed. And I've gotten that message, and I think that's one reason why best practices regulations, no matter how many theoretical objections can be raised to them and how many flaws they have to be part of the picture. We can't just rely on liability. We can't just rely on insurance. Secondly, I think it's very important to focus on what is going to be insured. David's paper is a little ambiguous about that, and I think Blaine's presentation was a very kind of gentle way of making this point, that insurance classically is casualty insurance, which means you're held liable in a lawsuit, and so the question is, what is the standard for liability? And if you start telling energy companies that they're going to be held absolutely liable to guarantee the water quality of the people who are surrounding your development project, that's a non-starter. They're not going to agree to that. So, again, I think this points toward the need for something like best practices as a supplemental liability regime. I've talked to a number of energy companies, and the word strict liability sends them straight to the door. I think they're a little bit misguided about that, but that's the reality. They're going to fight that tooth and nail. Finally, it'd be great if these insurance companies would be monitors of the behavior of the producers and the development companies, but I think the reality is that the modern insurance industry is really into pooling of risks and sort of trying to reduce their exposure that way rather than by monitoring the behavior of insureds. I think that's a great thing that they used to do back in the days of steam boiler insurance. I think it's fading away. It was part of the problem in the BP oil spill that the insurance companies were not doing any monitoring and so forth. So, again, I think insurance has some theoretical advantages, but they may not be the entire answer.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Brad, do you want to, you can just indicate if you want to say anything or I can go through a line.
Just very quickly, I think that I agree with the concept that insurance is not a panacea, although it may be necessary. We're now 30-plus years into Superfund, and yet, although there were things known as cost cap insurance for cost overruns on cleanups, what could be better, more easily assessed after 30 years than what it's going to cost to clean up a site? Those policies really aren't available anymore. Especially after 2008 and the collapse of AIG, there's a much different underwriting environment when it comes to environmental risks, and it's not encouraging in terms of ensuring an insurance market will be available. And it may not be as Leslie said, it may not be that establish the mandate and the market will follow. I'm not sure that would happen. I do think in terms of the best practices, Susan's point earlier is that there's a real gamut, and best practices has almost lost its meaning at this point because it's used in so many contexts by so many people, often describe not so very good practices to things that truly are state of the art. And so I think we need to, part of this debate is one of coming up with language that works both in common parlance, judicial parlance, administrative parlance, so that we know what we're talking about when we talk about best practices. And the third piece of it is again, I see that if we're ever going to have sensible regulations, it's efforts like the ones that Susan's undertaking at the Center for Sustainable Shale Development that are going to inform those regulations. And so I don't see best practices and prescriptive regulation as intention so much as they are complementary.
Thanks,
Guy.
Potentially complementary. Peter, do you want to add anything? Susan?
Well, I think one topic that we've touched on but we really haven't had the chance to explore, so I'll just throw it out there for further discussion, is the benefit of disclosure and the interest of the public in having as full disclosure as possible and the need for perhaps regulation that drives that kind of disclosure. And yet at the same time, disclosure by itself will get you just so far. The data needs to be put into a context. It needs to be explained. It needs, and that has to go hand in hand with the education function that we've talked about, that there really needs to be a concerted effort to make sense of this for the average person who really believes that there's probably a middle road, but they're confused by all the smoke.
Anyone else? I'd like to take like one question from the audience, but do you have something?
Sort of go back to the question of how we got to where we are. The industry has got to accept a significant amount of the blame for the response of states like New York and Vermont. The level of risk is directly proportional to the sense of outrage. And I forget the name of the Cornell professor who will give you a very long, explain why that is. But, you know, if the industry, I can't help but think that if the industry hadn't come to the Hill and asked for an exemption so that its sediment isn't a pollutant, it hadn't asked for an exemption so that it can inject these fluids in wells that don't demonstrate mechanical integrity the way that every other underground injection control program regulated well does, they wouldn't be facing every township in the northeastern states and the middle Atlantic states trying to ban the practice.
Yes, in terms of looking at the risk, and I think Brad addressed this, but both papers examine where the primary risks, the primary environmental impacts have been observed, and at least as I interpret both papers, those are really on the front end of the process. It's in the placement of the bore, it's in the drilling, it's in the casing, and it's in the disposal, the proper disposal of the produced water and the wastewater. Those can often be quantified. And then let's put off the possible, maybe it will never happen, migration of methane into the groundwater, migration of the fracking fluids from 10,000 feet below. Maybe those will never happen. We may want to have some assurance in case that does. But let's focus on the front end and where we know the risk of harm is the greatest and address those to begin with.
Leslie, do you have anything? All right. You know, it's very frustrating because this is just an amazing group of people, and we could obviously have a very, very long dialogue and discussion. I think we need to get ourselves back on track, unfortunately. So I'm going to ask if you wouldn't mind, maybe in this transition, if you all would be available at the back of the room for people to ask questions. We'd really appreciate that. Lunch is now available for people to grab. What we're going to do is just take a very short break, 5 minutes, and start with the next panel. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you very much. It's just terrific discussion.